It's a personal joy tonight to welcome back to Ballymoney Dr. Bill Woods. Our brother Bill is a personal friend, a close friend of our family, and a good friend of this congregation and to so many that are gathered in this church building tonight. But a year ago, when he was here, he said he was giving up preaching in English, but he very, very kindly consented to bring the missionary challenge tonight. And we trust that God will speak to you. These missionary weekends are here for a purpose. We want you to know about our missionaries. We want you to pray for them. We want to solicit your support for them as much as we can. But it's always our prayer that in these missionary weekends, God will deal with hearts, and that young men and young women and older people too, as George has spoken about tonight, will be called by the Lord, and you will feel that burden in your heart and see that vision tonight for the Lord's work and obey the command of the Lord in the Great Commission to go into all the world and preach the gospel. We had the privilege of visiting Bill very recently, just tell you that, in November. We'll be showing a little presentation of that tomorrow night. But we had a great time. I'll not go into all that we did, but we had a fantastic time. And he showed us around the work, and we were truly blessed. And he made great sacrifices because he gave up his bed for my wife and I to have. And I don't know, he slept somewhere else, but I'm sure it was comfortable enough. God bless you, Bill, as you come and speak to us. And we trust that tonight we'll all be challenged by what you have to say.
Very kindly consented. He wouldn't let me out of it. Mr. Park was with us in Brazil recently, and he realizes, of course, that my ministry there is ministering in the clinic, attending patients, doing operations, traveling around the interior of Brazil. And I certainly am not spending my time like the pastors and the preachers over here that spend their time preparing messages in English. And when I was invited to speak this evening, I didn't have any new material prepared. But I'm going to share something with you tonight that I spoke on many years ago in some of our churches. So you may have heard it, and you'll bear with me if you have. Don't do what someone did in Ballymena Church after I had preached. A man came to at the door, a man shook my hand, and he said, "You preached that one sermon better up in Sharton." So we're glad to be here tonight. I want to speak for a few moments this evening on the problem missionary. Ah, but somebody said no missionary should be a problem. No missionary should cause problems. That shouldn't exist. But there shouldn't exist problem members of the church or the congregation. There shouldn't exist elders that cause problems, or even pastors that cause problems, but because we're human beings, they do exist. And when I speak about the problem missionary or the missionary who was a great problem and caused problems, of course I'm referring to John Mark. And we read a little bit about him earlier on in the service. But before we think of the problems that John Mark caused, I want you to think of the John Mark as a privileged man. He was a privileged person. I would say, first of all, that he was reared in the midst of prosperity. The first mention that we have of his family, we read in Acts 4 and verse 36, where his uncle was surnamed by Barnabas by the apostles, which being interpreted as the son of consolation, a Levite, and of the country of Cyprus, having land, sold it, and brought the money and laid it at the apostles' feet. So his family had property. And then we read that Peter was in prison, and when he was released from prison, he came and he sought out the house of Mary. In Acts chapter 12, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. And as Peter knocked at the door, a damsel came to hearken, whose name was Rhoda. It's not very clear in our English translation here, But in Portuguese, it's even more specific. It says that one of the servants, or a maid, was sent to the door. And it would seem that the home of John Mark and his mother Mary, and probably his uncle Barnabas lived there too, they had prosperity and they even had a maid. Times were hard in that moment. Taxes were high. The Romans had taken over Palestine. But here was a family who even had a maid. Now you might think, yes it is, it's only a well-to-do family that have maids. During my first few years in Brazil, of course, we had a maid in the home that I lived in Canatama. Her name was Mondica, but we always called her Moaning Minnie. I wonder why she was always moaning. She had 15 children, but 12 of them died in childhood. Now, one of my other missionaries came to visit me once. Alan Loney came to stay with me, and he called my attention. He said, you know, the drying cloths that she uses to dry the dishes, she's drying her hands on them. I said, no, she's not, Alan. She always dries her hands on the curtains. But he said, I'm going to talk to her. So he went over and he spoke to her and he said, now, Donna Mundique, these cloths are only for drying the dishes. And she had one in her hand. Oh, she said, I know, I want to use them to dry the dishes. She said, excuse me. And she brought it up from her boot and blew her nose on it. Perhaps the maid in John Mark's house wasn't like that. Yes, they were a prosperous family. They had a large home. Because it says that many were gathered there praying. We're not told how many. But on a previous occasion, they say that there was 120 gathered together for prayer. Many years ago, when the Martyrs was at its best, and there were perhaps 2,000 in the congregation, Dr. S.B. Cook was taking the Sunday evening service. And when he came to the announcements, he said, now, Tuesday night, there's a missionary prayer meeting in the home of Mrs. McGuinness in Arrowhead Crescent. And she invites every one of you to come to that missionary prayer meeting. And S.B. did as only S.B. could. He turned one side of his brow up and the other down. And he said, if you all go, I don't know where she'll put you. But there was a large crowd in John Mark's house, so it was obviously a wealthy and a well-to-do family. He was blessed, yes, by prosperity. He was blessed with his parentage. His mother was a woman of prayer. But more than that, his uncle, Barnabas, was the first missionary and the great missionary that the church sent out. You remember that people came to know the Lord in Antioch. And Acts 11:22, we read, then the tidings of these things came unto the ears of the church which were in Jerusalem. And they sent forth Barnabas that he should go as far as Antioch. Now Barnabas was John Mark's tutor. He was his instructor. He was his example. He was his leader. And I haven't time tonight to think very much about Barnabas, but he was a giving man. We read that he gave all that he had to the Lord, not like Ananias and Sapphira. He was a gracious man. His nickname was the Son of Consolation. He was a guided man. Remember when Paul, Saul of Tarsus, got saved? He passed 3 years and still the Jews, the Christians in Jerusalem would not trust him. But we read in Acts 9, but Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared unto them how he had seen the Lord. And then when Barnabas was there in Antioch and the Lord was blessing, he went back and he got Paul. Then departed Barnabas to Tarsus to seek for Paul. And when he had found him, he brought him unto Antioch. And you'll read over and over again in the early history of the missionary work in the New Testament, in the Acts of the Apostles, you'll read Barnabas and Saul. Barnabas and Saul. Barnabas and Saul. And this man was John Mark's tutor. But John Mark was blessed too, because he was surrounded by prayer. His home was a place of prayer. And no doubt as he went forward with Paul and the others in his missionary endeavors, that same church, that same group, were praying for him, and how important that is. Some of you will have read the story of Molly Harvey. Molly Harvey went out with the Accra Gospel Mission in 1937. She was there for 30 years. She had previously been turned down by 5 missionary societies because of a bad heart. When she returned after her 30 years of missionary service, the 5 mission secretaries that had turned her down were all dead. But Molly Harvey, in her last year, almost in her last year, in her first term, which was 10 years, fell into the hands of an evil man. And as she struggled for her life, and he beat her and knocked her teeth out and really wounded her, finally she threw herself into the river and was finally taken out by 2 policemen. But when Molly was struggling in the arms of that evil man in the jungle of the Acre, right at the end of the Amazon Valley, there was a nurse at that very same moment on her knees in London in the Mild May Hospital praying for Molly Harvey. Pray for these people who are going to Kenya. Pray for our brethren who are going to Liberia, our brethren who are going to Papua New Guinea. For Joanne as she goes to Liberia. Oh, how important it is. I would encourage them as they anticipate going forward this year. I tell them the first 50 years are the worst. After that, you get used to it. You know, it's not so bad after the first 50 years. How often we stop in Brazil and say, someone was praying for us today. I was traveling downriver on one occasion in a little dugout canoe. We had a motor at the back, a man there working at the motor. In the front were 2 small boys. I was in the middle with a young man who was training to be a pastor. And we were going downriver to spend the night and have meetings and a little group of Christians down there. The river was really full. It was high water. We turned a bend in the river, and all of a sudden, there in front of us was a large ship. Now, we don't get them very, very, too large. For our region, it was an enormous ship, and it was heading straight towards. Of course, as soon as they saw us, they turned off their motors, they went to one side and pushed the canoe to the other side, and we got past it without hitting it. But the wake of it caught us. And the first wave knocked the 2 boys on the back, on their back, and flooded the canoe. And the second wave came over, and other waves came over. The people on the ship all ran to the back and to the side to look. And they were sure we were going down, and so were we. In front of me was a plastic basin with rice and fried bananas for our dinner. Food went into the river, and I began to bail. And I shouted, "Everybody bail! Try and get the water out! Everybody bail!" The pastor was sitting beside me. The young man was going to be a pastor. And I said, "Francisco, bail." He said, "What, with your hands?" He said, "I can't, I'll wet my watch." And he was sitting like this. Well, I could have hit him, but I didn't have time. But you know, somehow, that day we got to the edge of the river and pulled the canoe into the bank. Somebody was praying that day. But then I want you to think of John Mark as a problem missionary. He was a problem, and he caused problems. First of all, he deserted the work. He turned back at a certain point, and he said, "I'm not going any further." And Paul and Barnabas were going on to preach the gospel in other places, and John said, "I'm going back to Jerusalem." We're not told why he turned back. Sometimes we sit and think and wonder why John Mark turned back. Maybe it was because of the difficulties, the hardship that they were facing. And those that are going forward, and those that are in Liberia, and those that are in Kenya and Nepal and in Spain, and the missionaries and the pastors, they face hardships. It's not easy in the Lord's work. I think one day in late 1966, how hard a day that had been. We set out just after dawn, about 6 a.m. We walked all day. Part of the journey, we came to a river, and we had to get across, but there was just a bridge, like a brush shaft across, and
we had a gun because we would occasionally meet a leopard or something like that. We had to defend ourselves. And how would we get the gun over? So one of the woodsmen that was with us, he went over, holding on to branches up above and holding on. He got over to the other side. And then another one, he got more or less into the middle. And I was to go out as far as I could get, and holding on to a branch up here, and hand the gun over to him. And he would pass it then to the other one. But just as I was about to hand it over, my branch broke, and I went down into the water. But as I went down, I let fly with the gun in his direction. And then I caught my glasses, and I went under the water. I came up, I looked around, there was no sign of either of them. Where are they? And then one came up and swam to the bank, and the other one, he was struggling to his feet, plastered in mud, half in the water and half on the bank. And I said, what happened to you? The one in the middle, he said, well, you hit me up the face with a gun. And I went over backwards. So I threw it over my back as I went down. And the other one, he got it up the face too, and he went on his back in the mud. We walked all day. At about 6 in the evening, we lay down to spend the night on the jungle floor. There were mosquitoes. There were ants. We were wet. We were hungry. We were cold. I looked at Peter boy, a little Indian boy that was there beside me. And he was trembling in fear. Because he could hear, not very far away, the voices of the people, the Indians, the Jumi Indians, that he had watched while they killed his mother. And then they took him and put him in the river and tried to drown him, but somehow he escaped and managed to get away from their grasp and ran for 3 days through the jungle and eventually came out at the edge of the river and made his way up to where the missionaries were staying. And he could hear those people talking, and he knew that when dawn came, we would find them or they would find us. I looked at the woodsmen that were with us, and they were afraid. One of them would think of friends that they had met, and they were fishing in their canoe. They went into the Juma territory. They didn't realize they'd gone upriver too far. And when they found their bodies, they had difficulty removing them from the canoe. There were so many spears through them and right into the wood of the canoe. The other one think of a friend of his that the Juma's caught, and they cut his eyes out, cut his hands off, and left him to die in the jungle. And we lay there all night. We didn't know what was going to take place the next morning. It was hard. I was glad I knew the Lord had called me to preach the gospel to every creature. And I was in the place that the Lord wanted me to be. I hadn't read Victor Maxwell's book. It's not mine, by the way. It's Victor Maxwell's. So I didn't know that we'd have a peaceful contact the next morning with the Indians. But we did. I wonder, was it a relationship? Did he have a young lady there in Jerusalem that he was thinking about? Oh yes, it might have been the hardship, it might have been the relationship that he had to break off. I just arrived in Manas in 1960. I was in the street with Fred Orr one day, where this tall American lady came over. I think she was from Texas. Yes, she was from Texas. She didn't see me, she saw Fred, and she said, well, how are you all doing? And Fred said, well, I don't know about the others, but I'm all right. And then he introduced me, and afterwards when she moved away, he said, that's one of the most spiritual people you'll ever meet. And she was. Every time you met Annabelle, she just wanted to talk about the Lord and the things of the Lord. And she made a mark in the city of Manas. But when Annabelle was called to be a missionary, she was engaged. And she broke her engagement off to go to Brazil. After 5 years, she went back to the States. Her fiancé was waiting and said, now you've given 5 years to the missionary. I'm going back. After 15 years, after 20 years, each time she returned in furlough, he was waiting and asked her to marry her. After about 22 years in Brazil, they discovered that Annabelle had terminal cancer. And a letter came, she'd gone to the States for treatment. A letter came saying, well, she's going to get married and spend her last years with her fiancé. But then another letter came and she said, I lived in Brazil. I'm coming back to die in Brazil. Oh yes, it was a sacrifice. A relationship. Was that why John Mark moved back? I wonder, was it the ownership? There was property in Jerusalem. There was a home there. His mother was getting on. I wonder, did he think the wages here with Paul and Barnabas is very little? I'm not going to be able to keep up the property and keep my mother. And very often missionaries have financial needs as well. Now, in the town that I live in, doctors, colleagues, medical colleagues come from the big cities of Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo, and they're not very long in Rio Branco when they're buying a farm and raising cattle, and then they buy more cattle and they extend their land, and before long they have big ranches. And sometimes they come to me and they say, well, you've been here 32 years. You must have a lot of land. I said, oh yes, I do. The land I have is all here underneath my fingernails. That's the sort of land that I have. But I'm rich. I'm rich. I left the town of Tarawaka by boat on one occasion. I traveled up river for 15 days. We were tending patients at the side of the river. We got a little place called Jordan. We had to leave the boat, and then we traveled 5 days by canoe. And that wasn't easy either, because the river was so low and it was difficult to find the canal. And very often I was the one that had to walk in front in my bare feet, trying to find where the river was a little bit more deep so that the others could pull the canoe through. Finally, we left the canoe and we walked for 2 hours through the forest. We came to a little group of houses, and there was a man that we were looking for, and we didn't need anyone to introduce him. He had untreated leprosy for many years, and he was terribly, terribly deformed. The people looked at us in amazement. Who are you? And we explained, and a young woman standing there with a baby in her arms, she said, oh, I prayed and prayed that God would send someone with medicine for this disease. I said, we can't do much for your brother. She said, my brother? No, my son. Josie Meir, come here. And she called a boy of about 16. He had a large skin patch on his back. We examined. Yes, that's the beginning of leprosy. He has a disease that deformed his uncle. And if he doesn't have the medicine, he could end up the same way. I said, I'll not be back for a long time, but I'll make sure that the auxiliary nurse here brings the medicine every 3 months while he needs it. I later learned that he had been cured. His skin patch had disappeared. He'd been discharged. He'd been taken off treatment. Some time went by. And that elderly man got very ill. His leg became very infected. He needed the leg amputated. So they tied a hammock to a pole and they carried him out to the edge of the river. They put him in a canoe. They took him down to Jordan. From Jordan, they sent him down to the town of Tarawaka, put him in a little hospital there. And the people there said, no, he's not for us. We'll send him to Rio Branco where I and my team would take care of him. And they took him out to the airport. It was a taxi plane. Took five passengers and the pilot. And they put him in the plane and the pilot arrived. He was just new in the ACRI. He looked at the man so deformed and so disfigured. The bandages on his feet, he said, take him out. He's not traveling in my plane. There was a great discussion. They rang Rio Branco. The owner of the taxi airline company, he said to the pilot, you bring the patient or I'll give you the sack. You'll get fired. He said, I'll accept being fired. And they took the patient out, took him back to the hospital there where he eventually died. The pilot came to Rio Branco and lost his job. He was fired. But some time later, I was traveling again on that river. And I was at Jordan, and a young man, tall, we would say tall, dark and handsome. He was a tall man, and he was strong, and perfect hands and perfect feet, and the prime of health. He said, you don't know me. I said, no. He came into the boat. He said, you don't know me. I said, no. He said, I'm Josie Meir. I'm the little boy that you went upriver to treat. He said, I came first of all to thank you, but I want you to examine him, make sure I am cured. And he was. And I looked at that young man with perfect hands and perfect feet and perfect health and strength. And I thought of the uncle so deformed that the pilot was prepared to lose his job. And I thought, well, if I hadn't been there, he might have been in the same position. And that's wealth that money can't buy. I was traveling on another river, the Juruá. We stopped. We were using a school for our clinic there to attend the people. And when we were finishing up, the headmistress of the school called me outside and she said, now, you see those houses on the other side of the river? Do you see that little one there with the bright aluminium roof? I said, yes. She said, that's where we meet to preach the gospel. There are none of us here are believers, and we got together and we wanted to build a little church. And that's our little church. And it was a gift from Northern Ireland that built that church. And she said, every week we're preaching the gospel there. She said, you remember my son? I said, yes, I remember your son. For so long his leprosy was even under control. Couldn't get it under control. He was so ill. I said, where is he? What happened? She said, well, he came to the meetings and he got saved in that little church. A gift from Northern Ireland. That young man gets saved. I said, where is he? Oh, she said, he's gone to seminary. He's preparing to be a pastor. I tell you, that's worse. That's money. Wealth that money can't buy. People here in Northern Ireland who give, who pray, and who help are wealthy. We used to think something about hands, knees, and bumps of feet or something, but missionary work depends on hands, knees, and feet. Hands that give and care. Knees that bend in prayer. And feet that go to share. But perhaps it wasn't the hardship or the relationship or the ownership of his property that led John Mark to turn back. Perhaps it was because he realized his apprenticeship was over. He'd been training with Barnabas. He'd been training just as Paul was being trained. And maybe he realized that his ministry and his future was in some other place, in some other type of ministry. And if he had continued with them, he would have been perhaps the right person in the wrong place at the wrong time. You see, we read there in our reading tonight, the Holy Ghost said, separate me, Barnabas and Saul. And the Holy Ghost never said anything about John Mark going into the regions beyond, accompanying them. It was Barnabas and Saul. And so he turned back and went to Jerusalem. But I want to hurry on, because not only did he desert the work, he divided the workers. We read that after a while, some days, Acts 15, Paul said unto Barnabas, let us go again and visit our brethren in every city. And Barnabas determined to take with him John, whose surname was Mark. But Paul thought not good to take him with them, who departed from them, and went up with them to the work. And the contention was so sharp between them that they departed asunder one from the other. Here was a wonderful team. Barnabas and Saul, and now it had been changed over. Paul was in the leadership. It was Paul and Barnabas. But John Mark divided them. How easy it is for small things to divide missionaries and churches. Jock Purvis was a wonderful missionary from Scotland. He was a very good friend of the late Reverend Wiley and David Leatham and Dr. Paisley. They used to visit his home in Scotland. And Jock Purvis went to work for the Lord in Thailand, in Tibet. He and another English man, they were going there to win Tibet for the Lord, to bring the gospel to those people. And he always recalled that the first thing they noticed when they got there, the people that they were ministering to, they were so poor, and they had nothing. And the Lord convicted them with that verse that said, he that has two shirts, give to him that has one. And so they gave all their clothes away except the clothes they were wearing. And that was all right for a week, and 2 weeks went past, and George started to look at his shirt. He needed to wash, but he didn't have another one to put on while it was being dried. But they were sharing just one little room. And in the evening they got down to have their prayers, and Jock liked to sleep with the window open, and his colleague liked to sleep with the window closed. And after the time of prayer, Jock would get up and go over and open the window. And the other missionary would go over and open it. And Jock would get back up out of bed again, he'd go over and he'd open the window, and the other one with his cool wife like me, he would go and close the window. And it became such a contention between to open the window or close the window that they spent weeks without speaking to each other. Until one day Jock was on his knees and the Lord said to him, He said, Lord, break that stubborn fellow's heart. He's so stubborn. The Lord said, no, it's you that's stubborn. He didn't know that at the same moment his colleague was praying the same thing, and the Lord said, it's you that's stubborn. So Jock got up and opened the window. And the other fellow got up and closed it, and it started all over again, but in reverse. And then they fell on each other's shoulders and wept and said, we've been divided just for such a small, small item. But he deviated the work. We read there that the contention was so great they parted asunder one from the other, and so Barnabas took Marcus and sailed for Cyprus. And we never hear of Barnabas again. We never hear he had a great ministry in Cyprus or what he did. The only reference we have later on, Paul said even Barnabas was carried away by their doctrine. But the story doesn't end there. John Mark, who was a privileged man, a problem missionary, became a profitable minister. 2 Timothy, Paul writes in chapter 4 and verse 11, take Mark and bring him with thee, for he is profitable to me in the ministry. Peter said, and the church does salute you, and Marcus, my son. And John Mark, somewhere along the line, he found his ministry. He found this place where the Lord had prepared for him, the work that he had prepared for him. And the blessings that came from John Mark's pen, I have them in my hand today, the Gospel of Mark. The problem missionary became a profitable minister in the Lord's hands. I went into an old broken down house. The walls were there, but the roof had fallen. Part of the roof had fallen in. The doors were off. The windows were off. It was strewn with rubbish and rats and smelling. But it was the home of the worst drunkards and drug addicts and down and outs and criminals that lived in the city of Manaus. And I went in with a young fellow from the church, and there in the back of that room, they were all there, but they were all stoffish drunk. And over at the back, we found who we were looking for. A young man who had given such a bright testimony in the church, had been such a blessing, was he had a wonderful voice and sang and led the meetings. And then he disappeared. We wondered where he was. His family didn't know where he was. And there he was, this young Christian, absolutely stinking and stoshes drunk, absolutely unconscious. We slapped his face, we talked to him, we tried to get him to wake, and he woke up, he looked with his eyes, they said, go away, it's all over. I've disgraced the church. I've disgraced the Lord. I can't go back. And they said, no, God still loves you. And so do we. And we trailed him out and took him home. Last year I was in Manaus. I was in a restaurant having a meal. And I looked across the table at the man that was sitting in front of me, and I said, and you tell me that you're retired. He said, yes, I'm retired. I spent 30 years as a pastor, and now I'm retired, but he said, I preach every week, and I'm always active in the church, even though I am retired. And I thought of the night that we trailed him out, stoshes drunk, because the young man that had been a problem in our church became a profitable minister. Fran and Elsie Robatham gave up a very prosperous business in Birmingham, and they went to Colombia to serve the Lord as missionaries with the WEC mission. It didn't work out. Elsie Robatham, or we called her Maro, she couldn't work with anybody. There was conflicts, there was friction, there was always something going on. And finally the mission told them, look, you're not suitable here, you have to go back again to England, and they sent them home. Problem missionary? But was it the end of their ministry? No. The Lord took them to Scotland. And in Scotland, it was through Maro's prayers and Maro's faith that the missionary training college came into being. And those people who had been rejected on the mission field came back to serve the Lord in a wonderful way in preparing missionaries to go out over the world, missionaries are all over the world today and still preaching the gospel. People like Fred and Ina Orr, Victor Maxwell, the Reverend Stanley Barnes, myself, and hundreds of others. They became profitable ministers in the right place at the right time. And so it's important that we be in the right place at the right time. Jim Rogers was a talented school teacher, a secondary school teacher in Scotland. He was a brilliant pianist. And he applied to the WEC mission to go to Africa, to the Belgian Congo, to teach school there. And they said, you're not suitable. A couple of years later, he applied again. And this time they accepted him to go for a year or two just to see how he would get along. He was only in the Belgian Congo a very short time. Perhaps I think in just a few months. When in 1964 the revolution took place and the Simbas took over. And he and all the other foreigners were taken prisoner, not knowing what their fate would be. Bill McChesney was the son of a pastor in the United States. But his father was a pastor of a very small church and they were very poor. And right up until the time that Bill left for Africa to be a missionary, the household only had one room, one bedroom. And he and his brother always slept on the sofa in the living room. He spent 5 years in Africa. He was coming up to the time when he would be leaving on furlough. And he was saving up so that he'd have some money when he went home on furlough. He'd been poor all his life, and now he was here in Africa, and saving hard so he'd have money to take with him home. He had $90 saved up. He became very ill with malaria, very ill with dysentery. And then the Simbas came and found out that he was an American. They took him out and they really beat him very severely. And then they threw him into the place where all the other foreigners were prisoners. But they threw him into the arms of Jim Rogers and into his care. Bill couldn't stand. But during the long hours of the night that followed, Jim Rogers tried to comfort him and tried to ease his pain and talk to him and prayed with him. And then when dawn came, the Simbas came back and they said, all the Americans and all the Belgians would get outside. But Bill couldn't stand. He couldn't walk. So Jim Rogers picked him up and carried him out. And as he stood outside there with him in his arms, people shouted, tell them you're from Scotland. You're not an American. You're not a Belgian. Even a Roman Catholic priest said, put him on the ground and go back in. He said, no, I can't leave my friend, my colleague. And while he was still in Jim's arms, the Simbas came with rough clubs and they beat him over the head and beat Bill to death. As Jim laid him to the ground, then they came back with those bloodstained themed buttons and they beat him to death. God took him to Africa, the right person, in the right place, at the right moment, just to minister and to help his dying colleague. But he paid a price. There was hardship, there was separation, there was all that. God speaking tonight, be sure you're in the right place at the right time. He always makes his call. Very sure.